Hi there, and welcome to our podcast, Mindfulness at Work. I'm Cara Pollard.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to the Mindfulness at Work podcast. I am so excited and thrilled to have with us today Dr. John Duffy. Dr. Duffy is a highly sought-after clinical psychologist and best-selling author. He also hosts the podcast and parenting relationship expert Heidi Stevens from the Chicago Tribune, who's a wonderful columnist. The podcast is called On Purpose, the Heidi Stevens and John Duffy podcast. He also has a podcast with his amazing wife and life partner, Julie Duffy. Julie also helped him co-author and edit his latest parenting book called Parenting the New Teen in the Age of Anxiety. And it's just so timely. I can't tell you how informative it is for all times, but especially during the pandemic. It's your go-to book for helping yourself and your teen with anxiety. And he also wrote the book, The Available Parent. John talked a lot about how we can be available as parents, but I like to say he's the available psychiatrist or psychologist. Are you a psychiatrist or psychologist, John?
I'm a psychologist.
A psychologist. Well, you are available to many and just such a gift to all of us in helping us with our many trials and tribulations going through life. Your love of teens is just inspirational to me. And I think it's probably inspirational to the most of the parents that you work with as well. So welcome, John. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, my friend. And a lot of those compliments go right back to you. So I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, John. I'm just so glad to have you. I know there is a lot of anxiety out there right now. And I think it's pretty serendipitous that you came out with this book right before the pandemic hit. You were going on a book tour, you were speaking everywhere. I bet it was well received. In fact, I know it was. I went to a couple of those talks and thought that they were fabulous. What did you think of the book tour then, and what were the parents asking you for and kind of asking about anxiety and what they could do at that point?
Well, it kind of speaks to why I wrote the book in the first place. I didn't intend to necessarily, but I realized in the past maybe 4 or 5 years that the gap of knowledge that parents have about the lives of their teenagers became broader and broader and broader, where teenagers would disappear into their rooms and parents wouldn't know what they're looking at online, what the information they're consuming, whether it's useful or not, whether they were vaping or juuling, or there were a lot of just verbiage that teenagers were using the parents were wholly unaware of. And so this book was intended to inform parents that, hey, we don't know what it's like to be a teenager. You know, we think we do because we remember what it was like when we were 16, but 16 is so different now than it was when we were kids. And the teenage years have stretched. So our 8 and 9 year olds know a lot more than we probably had access to at 13. And on the back end, our 23, 24-year-olds are still developing and still trying to find their way in the world, whereas a lot of us had the luxury of finding it a lot sooner. So what we've been talking about up until about the middle of March was just kind of like, hey, let's all get up to speed so our kids aren't forced into the position of introducing us again to what it's like to be a teenager. You know, so we're really not starting from ground zero, because it's hard enough right now to be a teenager. And in the last 7 months, it has become exponentially more difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really sad to see some of the struggles that the teenagers are going through. We don't know how to maneuver through this, so how should they? I like what you're saying, and yet it's kind of bad news for parents, right? Why do we want to extend the teen years any more than they are? So you're saying that they're, in your book, there isn't really a tween segment anymore that's been eradicated because the kids are growing up so fast. And ironically, on the back end, they're not maturing enough to go out and live on their own. So we have this longer period of dealing with a teenager when their brains aren't fully formed and they're not making rational decisions and they are not risk averse, but seeking risk. And so there are things that are hard for us as parents. And anxiety is at the forefront of most of that. Now, can you tell me just from a clinical sense, like what a definition of anxiety is? And maybe if you could delineate it in just in my lay terms too, there's good anxiety, there's bad anxiety, and there's chronic anxiety. So maybe just a couple words about all three of those different types.
Right. Years ago when I was in graduate school, I learned about something called the Yerkes-Dodson rule. It kind of cracked me up that it took two people to come up with this rule, but effectively it was basically a bell-shaped curve that they came up with. And they were talking about the stress and performance combination. And they said, you need a certain degree of stress on the front end of the curve. You need a certain degree of stress and anxiety in order to perform well, right? So you don't want to be understressed. Otherwise, you're kind of that couch potato. You don't have any anxiety. And we need some good anxiety to motivate us and get us going and get us charged up and get us excited about things. And so I think we are under a false perception kind of culturally that all anxiety is bad, needs to be eradicated, medicated away, when in fact most anxiety is necessary and gets us going. And when we're right in the zone and we feel like, okay, I'm writing my book just the way I want to, or I am making every shot that I take, that's where anxiety and performance are perfectly balanced. You know, every once in a while, we've all felt that. Csikszentmihalyi down at the University of Chicago called it flow. But whatever you call it, it's this area where somehow in this symbiotic way, things seem to gel kind of perfectly in that combination of anxiety and performance. On the back end of that curve, if you can picture the curve dropping, we're overstressed and we become overly anxious and worried about worrying and really anxious about just about everything in our lives. And that's where our performance starts to deteriorate in ways that we have difficulty controlling. So the goal is to slide back up that curve so that we get to that state of flow more readily, because if we fall too far down that curve, then we become actually symptomatic, right? And we become a little phobic. We begin to worry about things that we wouldn't ordinarily worry about, and we have trouble finding our compass of reason when it comes to what to worry about, what not to worry about, what just to act upon.
So it's a distortion in your thinking that's out of balance. Is that
perfectly put? Yes.
Okay. And I've also heard it said that that backside of the curve expands, and we don't know how to get back or have an off button to it. We just, an off switch, so to speak. We just keep kind of ruminating in the thought process. Is that?
It does. And that rumination is a vortex. It's very difficult to get out of ruminating once you begin doing it. It's a vortex heading downward. In other words, like, you know, we in my field, we like to think that anxiety and depression, for example, are disparate, completely separate entities, when in fact there is overlap. Anxiety in the extreme is depressing. Depression in the extreme is anxiety provoking. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of overlap and we become symptomatic in all those ways. That's why medications like Prozac and Zoloft treat both anxiety and depression, because they're intertwined for an awful lot of us. Usually one or the other leads, but most of us carry some anxiety and most of us carry some depression. And the idea is not to eradicate every element of that, but to just find a zone that works for us. And you're right, we want to avoid the vortex that kind of pulls us down deeper into anxious, ruminating thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I call it the downward spiral. And I think that you can go on a downward spiral. And then from a parent's viewpoint, I have seen it with my clients and even with myself, you start catastrophizing and you believe that being late to pick your kid up from school means that they're never, ever going to have self-esteem. Or if your teenager smokes pot, that they're going to live in your basement for the rest of their life, just being, you know, a burnout or whatever the term is these days. So tell me why you think that this state of our environment of constantly giving directives, of information overload, of repetitiveness, of questioning our teens and even our kids adds to their anxiety.
Okay, so let's go back in time. So you're right, before the pandemic, starting September 15th of last year when my book first came out, I was on a speaking tour. It was lovely and really well attended up until March 12th. But in that time before then, the goal was we were trying to get parents informed about what it was like to be a teenager, because not knowing and guessing, or you know, telling kids get off the screen, not knowing what's going on the screen, you know, is that there is this kind of free-falling feeling that parents have. And the way we respond is with our own fear and our own judgment and our own ego about, you know, like, am I failing as a parent? Am I doing this wrong? Are they going to be able to make it? Are they going to make it out in the world? Or is whatever's happening right now, the fact that they're not doing homework and they're looking at TikTok, is this somehow going to become a problem in their lives? Just like you're talking about, this catastrophizing idea, right? As opposed to maybe this is just a rite of passage in the new teen, right? Maybe this is just what kids do in order to decompress a little bit and then get back to it. So it's really kind of getting informed as a parent, but also keeping your own stuff in check and recognizing what's yours and what's your child's. Because if we lay too much of our fear, judgment and ego on our kids, we forget how much they're carrying of their own. And then all of a sudden they're carrying a backpack that's just too heavy and they become symptomatic.
Yeah. So can we pause there? And I mean, I happen to read both your books, obviously, voraciously, and thought that every word really resonated with me. But you bring up fear, judgment, and ego in the your most recent book, but it was a concept that I think you came up with and really talked more deeply about in The Available Parent. And it's just something that's in my mind every time I'm coaching a client, every time I have an interaction with a kid. I think it's super important to ask where it's coming from. So can you just touch upon each of those and briefly tell us what coming to your child as a parent with fear, judgment, and ego present means or looks like?
Well, yeah, yes. I'm going to walk your listeners, if it's okay with you, through a little exercise here. So think of an issue that you are struggling with one of your children. I don't care what age your child is, but just consider an issue that you're concerned about, that you're struggling with. And for a moment, take a deep breath and think about what your fears are relative to that issue. What are you most afraid of? What is your worst case scenario? Because that's what we tend to entertain when we get afraid. Now, and if you want to, take a moment, write that down. Mm-hmm. And then when you're through with that, consider judgment. In what ways are you judging your child for not working hard enough, not being engaged enough, not doing their job enough when you feel like you're doing yours? Think about the degree to which you might be judging yourself as a parent. I'm not doing a good enough job. I can't get them motivated. Why can't I get them off the couch or off their beds, right? And you can write that down if you like. You like to take a moment. And then consider your own ego and the role your ego plays in this. What I typically cite is the bumper stickers on the back of the car. And our egos say, I want the Princeton bumper sticker. I want the activities for all the various things. I want to show off my child. I'm not saying that that's a bad thing. I think most of us carry some of that pride in our child. But our egos sometimes get in the way of parenting effectively, because we sometimes too often look at our kids as part of our report card as parents, as opposed to entities that stand on their own and are going to make their own choices, their own mistakes, and have their own victories as well. So what I encourage in parents is to, as often as possible, but nobody's perfect at this, this is not an exercise in perfection, to take your own fear and your own judgment and your own ego, and for just a while, put it aside, and then you can problem solve effectively, and you can even determine whether you have a problem or just a situation. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think taking yourself out of this crisis kind of zone, this catastrophic zone, into like, I just have a situation to address. I'm going to sit down and talk to him or her about what's going on and get a feel for where they are and see if we can't work together and collaborate on moving forward, mm-hmm. you know, as opposed to I'm going to try to rule with an iron fist and tell them this isn't good enough and we need to, you know, you can sense the difference. And we have this proclivity, I think, to lecture our children often when in fact, I think we all fundamentally know when we're lecturing, we lose our kids really, really fast. Even if it worked for our parents, the lectures and the threats and the you're going to lose, you're going to be grounded for the rest of your life. Our kids are wise. They're onto us in a way that I kind of like because I prefer the idea of connection and collaboration over iron-fisted parenting because mm-hmm. we're really developing relationships with our kids for a lifetime, not just for this time. And I think most parents would say, I want my kid to be able to turn to me 20 years from now if he or she is struggling with something. And I don't want to be an impediment in their lives or something they feel like they have to engage with, but I want to be somebody who helps them along in their lives. I want to be an ally and a guide mm-hmm. and a consultant.
Yeah, that's such a good way to put it. And I think that so often we do view things as a crisis situation when in fact, if you have collaborative skills or even conflict resolution, you can bring that to your child with the idea that, and I think you once said, and it stuck with me, like, do you want your kid to want to come home for Thanksgiving with their family? So if you have that in mind, or do you want your adult child to come to you with a problem so that you can work it out? So what you're doing today will really affect that. And going back to fear, ego, and judgment, it sounds to me, is it all entwined with projection? Are all three of those things that we are projecting onto our kids?
I'll be honest, Cara, I never really thought about that before, but yes, these are all projective entities.
Yes.
Exactly right. So if we can keep our own projection in mind, because we're kind of projecting our identities onto our kids. And there's a few stories that I like to tell, but I'll share one really briefly here. I've talked about it for years, but it was really kind of, it made an impact on me and it's happening more and more lately, which is encouraging. I worked with a father and son, and dad had a very specific trajectory he wanted his child to follow, right? He was going to do what he did. He was going to be a business major. He was going to major in finance. And here this 15, 16-year-old boy was. He's growing his hair long. He's skateboarding. He's way outside the bowling alley that dad wants him in, the narrow lane that dad wants him in. He's well outside the alley. And one point, dad comes downstairs thinking he's studying for the ACT. And he is, dad's like, you know, it's late. What are you doing? Oh, and he says, I'm making beats. I'm rapping. And dad pauses. So instead of saying, you know, are you crazy? You know, put that down and get back to work. He sits down and he listens to the raps. And he kind of picks up on the idea that, oh, this is pretty good. Like I get, you have some talent here. You're working towards something. And so for a moment he got on that lane. Eventually he said, well, we do have the ACT to work on. And so get back to work on that. But I get why this draws you in mm-hmm. and I want to hear more of this. So instead of doing what I think he was initially have been inclined to do, were he just projecting and, you know, all his fear, all his judgment, all his ego onto his child and saying, no, you have to put that down right now and you have to get to work. He'd be missing this massive strength, right? This maybe the most important thing. Now this in this particular family happened years ago. And this young man now is in, I'll leave it at, he's in a fairly creative enterprise. He is not a rapper, mm-hmm. but I think he's channeled that creativity into something that will eventually land a vocation for him. And were it not for his father kind of recognizing like, oh, this, you're a creative guy. You're mm-hmm. different than I am. You know, like this is interesting. I'm going to have to learn from you about all of this because I don't understand any of it. I don't even know if I like it, but I'm going to get behind it because you like it, you know?
Right.
I think that's a really important thing.
I think you've said that before, like approaching it with curiosity, right? You know, openness, curiosity. That's a really good way that we can approach our kids. And it seems like, to me, part of the rise in their anxiety, besides the projection of the ego, judgment, and fear, is that we're approaching our kids like they're a project, right? Or, you know, we're in this, before the pandemic, in this fast-paced, performative culture, we're doing a checklist, you know, soccer, check, straight A's, check, ACT, 36, check. And all of that is based on projection, fear, and ego. And instead of knowing how our kids learn, knowing who they are, we're treating them like a checklist, which I think just exacerbates anxiety because it's not real. It's not connection. And so I think that that's really sad. And I hope people can hear what you're saying about being open and curious to listening to who they are and what some of their talents might be instead of squelching their creativity.
And it's interesting to hear you point out the reality that it's really sad because the overriding feeling I get from parents at the core is sadness, this disconnect, and wondering like, how do I get that back? And part of it is taking the checklist. It takes a lot of courage, I think, to this massive leap of faith to take the checklist, put it aside, trust your parenting, trust your child, and trust that things are going to work out the way they're supposed to if you get on board their train as opposed to pressing them to get on board yours. I do think that that takes courage, but it is courage. It's a leap worth taking. And it is regrettable on the back end if you don't take it because that disconnect is really hard to repair once the teen years have passed, right? And kids are looking back and saying, oh, with my fully developed brain now, I see that this didn't work out very well. I don't love the way I was parented, right? And I always often ask parents while I'm speaking with them, how do you feel about the way you were parented? You know, because not everybody looks back and thinks, you know, like that was, my parents did a really, really great job. A lot of us look back and think like, it was disconnected in a lot of ways. I felt distant from my parents. I didn't feel like they were allies. I felt like they were impediments to what I really wanted.
Yeah, it is sad. And I think you mentioned that nobody is doing this because they're evil people. I think that we don't know what we don't know. And so unless you're seeking information from you or hiring a coach or working on yourself, really, just working on yourself would help to eradicate most anxiety that I think we dump onto our kids. And at the same time that we're checking the checklist, can you talk about how the far opposite end of that is that we rescue them? So we do the checklist, we almost break them by making them get the A's. And then on the far end, we think we have to coddle them and be a concierge to them, maybe in order for them to get the A's. I'm not exactly sure, but how that in and of itself is part of the cause of the rise in anxiety.
Well, to your point, parents have the best of intentions. They want their kid, you know, parents come to me, when parents come to you, I assume, when I ask them, what do you want for your children? Usually it's, I want them to be happy. I want them to be good people. It isn't usually, I want them to get a 34 or higher on the ACT. I want them to go to Princeton. Mm-hmm. You know, like this is not what parents say. This is often what their actions reflect. But you're right. Like on the other end of the spectrum, sometimes my wife jokes that this was our problem raising our son, is we micro-coddled our son. and I think we do this because we love our kids. Not many of us want to see our kids uncomfortable, struggling, working their way through a really, really long night of homework. And so there's this inclination like, maybe I could help out and write this paper. Or with us, it was, you know, he doesn't have to join the swim team. It's too hard. He has to get up too early. That's not what we do, you know? Mm-hmm. And sometimes the most important thing to do is to allow your child to be in the hands of somebody who is willing to teach them the competence and grit and tenacity and resilience that we aren't going to be able to do on our own. And that is mighty parenting in my mind, is to recognize, oh yeah, I'm not going to be the parent. I'm not going to be able to press and, you know, make my child work really, really hard. But kids need to know what they're made of. So if we're not the ones doing that, I'm always encouraging some kind of club, group, sport, play, other activity, the orchestra, debate, whatever it is, so that they have other adults pressing them and expecting them to do really, really well in something, because it changes the whole perspective of a young person when they realize, oh, I can do the thing, you know, like I can achieve the thing. So, and you know, as opposed to talking about what we don't want our kids to do, you know, will you please put the phone down? Will you turn off the computer, the TV, or the, you know, the gaming system, to focus more on the positives and get them engaged in things that we want them doing more of the time, then this other stuff becomes the margins of their lives. It doesn't become the main event. They're not just, you know, Snapchat kings and queens. They become adept at something, and that just becomes a way of communicating with their friends, right? We tend to focus on what we don't like instead of encouraging what we do. And it's the things that teach our kids competence, resilience, tenacity, and grit. That's where we want them engaged. And those are the goals of parenting. You know, when we send our kids off to college or whatever is next, if those are the traits they carry, no matter what it is that they're doing, they're going to succeed. You know, whatever success means, they're going to do well.
Right. And it will be their definition of success and not ours. And I think when you bring up grit, resilience, and growth, it's so good to encourage your kid. I mean, I think half of them, and you talk about this, they think if they're not going to be perfect at something, they won't try it. And that, and they'll even give up completely. If I can't get all A's, I'm not going to do my homework at all. If I can't be the fastest swimmer on the swim team, why go at all? And to me, that's when you're not a good swimmer, go join swim team. So you're not a good athlete and you do choir, well, try soccer, because, you know, that shows you that you have this ability and strength and empowerment within yourself to grow and be better at something that you weren't that good at to begin with. And so I've said to parents about anxiety and even anything, when we try to rescue them, in trying to fix it, we exacerbate it. And in trying to rid it, we perpetuate it. And so if you could say that to yourself, I think that, and really believe it, if you believe it, then you could, you know, maybe just get out of that bowling alley lane and look at things from a wider perspective. I think that would be helpful. So when we talk about anxiety being good, like, I just thought it would be cool to talk about how it is a valuable, like, messenger sometimes. I had a panic attack once, and I was negotiating a contract for rent in my other business. And I didn't know what it was, honest to God. I did not know. I started feeling super, like, not, it wasn't a hot flash. I just felt flushed, tingly. I felt like I was going to faint. I had to ask the guy I was negotiating with for water. And I still, to this day, I know it was a panic attack, but I also, I didn't end up having a good rapport with this guy, and he tried to cheat me out of some things. And I seriously still think that it was like a message system to me at the same time as me having a panic attack. So do you buy that, or do you think I'm giving myself too much credit?
I do not think you're giving yourself too much credit. I when somebody describes a panic attack or a marked spike in anxiety, even if it's just short of a panic attack, I'm always looking for, like, tell me what the situation is around that in your life right now, because anxiety is often a liar. Anxiety can also be a great truth teller. And I'll tell on myself here for a moment. I was a CPA in another life working for a firm that I thought was going to be around forever, but the Enron scandal was the end of Arthur Andersen, it turns out. But in any event, for years, I would every day, Cara, have panic attacks. And I thought, well, I'm just an anxious person. That's just my deal. This is what's going to happen for the rest of my life. And at one point I went and saw a therapist, and she was very clear, like, oh, that's a messenger. That's telling you that there's something in your life that isn't working very well. What do you think that is? And I was like, my job. I said it like within, within 15 seconds. And the very quick answer was, so what would it be like if you were doing a different job? And it was like nirvana, you know, like anything else felt great other than this particular thing. And within 6 months, I was in, you know, back heading toward grad school, doing something I knew I was far better suited for, but just afraid to pursue.
Well, thank you for pursuing it. We're so happy you had panic attacks, John. Now we all get to learn from you. But I'm wondering, and I'm sure you have, but have you shared this with your son, like as an example of what anxiety looks like and how you can try to be self-relationally aware to, you know, to what your needs are?
Yes, my poor son. I have one child. George is 25 now, but through his teen years, he was my petri dish of a test case, right? So he was a constant experiment, and he was aware of this. Like I told him, you know, like I'm working on parenting. I work with a lot of teenagers. Now you're a teenager, so if I'm ever missing it, if I'm missing the mark, if I'm crossing the line, if you feel like I don't get it, I want you to stop me and I want you to tell me what it is I don't get. And if you feel that spike in anxiety, I think parents are sometimes reticent to describe to their kids what their own experiences were, but this made us really close because George really understood, like, okay, I'll let my dad know if I feel anxiety. And it happened on occasion. I don't think he ever met the point of quite a panic attack, but there were times where, oh, I don't think I'm doing as much as I could, you know, and I feel that. I feel that in my gut somewhere. And, you know, and so he's making this mind-body connection that's really, really important. And so a lot of the kids I work with, I'm kind of training them to do the same thing, to recognize that that anxiety, as uncomfortable as it is also a little bit of a gift to you because it's a messenger telling us, okay, let's try something different here and see if that doesn't eradicate the anxiety on its own. And I do that, Cara, before we ever get anywhere near a psychiatrist or anything like that, as long as somebody's functioning well.
Yeah, I think that's so important because I talk to parents more often about when they are dumping their anxiety or when they are bleeding, I think is the word you use, or their kids are absorbing it. They can show them right in the moment some chill techniques or some grounding exercises, or, you know, when you just mentioned you taught George the connection to his mind and body, people used to think that breathing techniques and meditation and mindfulness were all woo-woo and a bunch of BS, and really there's physiological reasons, right? Like if your brain is in a state of fight or flight, it's sending a message to your lungs to constrict your breathing. And so you can hijack that by doing square breathing. And it isn't woo-woo, it's actually physiological. So if you're having an attack and you do that in front of your kids, or if you're screaming and you're triggered and you come back and say, you know what, that was just so out of line, I actually was thinking about this meeting I have later with my boss, you're right there giving them an in-the-moment example of things that they can do when they're feeling that way. And so I often try to, you know, tell my clients to do stuff like that.
I love that. And I agree wholeheartedly. And these things that luckily, I think, fortunately for us now, today, these things that were considered woo-woo, now a lot of our kids are adapting and adopting pretty readily. Girls and boys, to my surprise, the Calm app and the Headspace app. And you've got like people, athletes like LeBron James doing meditations that, you know, my 15-year-old kids are, you know, actually attending to, and they'll sit and do the meditation while in between sessions out here in the waiting room. And it's really very heartening to know, like, kids are, you know, one thing I lament a little bit is how familiar kids are with the mental disorders they could suffer, right? But they also have some bead on how to mitigate them, you know, and this is part of competence and resilience. We're all going to run into moments of anxiety in our lives. And if we can do the square breathing and navigate that, modulate that on our own, you talk about like really feeling like I can take on the world. If I can manage what's happening in my body, I can manage the situation far better than I think I would have felt otherwise.
Right. It's funny you say that. My son had people over to watch the Bears game in a projector outside. And one of the kids brought my husband an Eckhart Tolle book because he knows my husband meditates and he's been listening to him. And, you know, my husband told him why he was meditating, and it was because of stress. And so this kid, without completely saying it, I think, is trying to learn how to mitigate his own stress by reading books, listening to podcasts, and he's trying meditation. And he said, it isn't going well, but my husband said, just keep trying. So I think that example of being an adult who says when we're wrong and really apologizing and showing our kids in real life moment-to-moment processes of our thought patterns could be really, really helpful. So I wanted to quickly ask you about your alma mater and Father Jenkins going to the super spreader event at the Supreme Court, and what you thought of his apologetic letter to the students at Notre Dame, and if he had missed an opportunity at all.
Yeah, so I actually do think that Father Jenkins missed an opportunity. Early on, Notre Dame notoriously mishandled, I think, the pandemic, and there was an element to my thinking, and I went there. I think I'm going to take the liberty of saying, okay, as an alum, I think there was an air of arrogance to this idea that, you know, like, we're somehow going to be immune to this virus that seems to be infecting the entire country.
Right.
The classes were in person very quickly, and it was a little looser on Notre Dame's campus, and North Carolina, I think, was another example of that, but Notre Dame specifically. So Father Jenkins was very quick to chastise the kids who were gathering, despite knowing full well that everything about the university setting, everything about the adolescent brain would suggest that young people are going to violate the rules here, you know, and they're not doing it absolutely recklessly. They recognize, like, well, I'm not home with my parents or grandparents right now, and we are well aware that the likelihood of us getting it might be a little higher here, but spreading it, we're probably going to spread it to people who are 19 or 20, and it will be, you know, it'll make us sick for a day or two, and then we'll be done with it, you know, kind of like that. And then Father Jenkins goes to this event, right, and does not wear a mask, and actually infects himself with coronavirus. And he had this opportunity to say, wow, I so understand where you were. And I was so quick to judge, and I get it now. And I get how important it is to take this all very seriously. And I sincerely apologize to mm-hmm. the student body, not kind of a cursory kind of, like, you know,
right.
I apologize, but really to make note of his connection to what these young people were going through, right? And maybe even citing, like, I even know what it feels like to feel that pressure socially to not mask up. You know, like, maybe I felt like I should, but nobody out there was doing that, and it felt kind of weird to me,
right,
to put a mask on. You know, just what should be really forthcoming would, in almost a parental way,
yes,
a father way, you know, create a different connection with these young people, where I think they would have been very forgiving, very much on his side, as opposed to calling for his resignation in the student newspaper, you know,
right,
which ended up what ultimately they ended up doing.
Did they?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. And I thought about each step of the way his decision-making process in his letter. His apologetic letter, I briefly read, and he said something like, I thought Notre Dame should be represented. And I thought, right there, John Duffy would call that his ego.
Definitely.
That was his ego. He wanted to be there because his ego was proud of Notre Dame. Fine. But that one decision, then he went there, could be like somebody at a frat party telling you to, you know, do 8 shots when you know you're going to get sick. They told you to take your mask off. He goes out, he sees the chairs. Well, he could have pulled the chairs further apart.
Sure.
Yes, he would have looked like an idiot, but he could have made all these analogies, I believe, to kids and say, I understand more. And by the way, your brain is informed, so I should have known better. But he kind of took a I don't know, just a hierarchical, apologetic tone. And so I'm sad that he's gone, but I'm not surprised because he missed an opportunity. And I think as adults, we, and especially as parents, we should really look for those opportunities, especially when the stakes are as high around anxiety, to show our kids how we're not going to dump our anxiety onto them, how we're going to serve ourselves and really square breathe, meditate, whatever it is, to quell our own anxiety and not put our anxieties onto them. And you are the most knowledgeable person I could have talking about anxiety. So I really appreciate you being here and sharing all of your knowledge with us, John. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. And thank you for all the wonderful work you're doing. I'm always excited to listen to this podcast and I'm honored to be on it.
Well, absolutely. Thank you. I'm glad you listened to it. I listened to both of yours. And we will hopefully have people, if they need to reach out to you, they can do so. If they need your book, I think it's really important to get. It's Parenting the New Teen in the Age of Anxiety. It will resonate with you. Go get it. It should be flying off the bookshelves. And thank you, John. Have a great rest of your day.
You too, friend.
Thank you for listening to Mindfulness at Work. If you felt inspired by our conversation, we hope you'll share our podcast with your friends and colleagues.